here it is, round four of our 3-minute fiction short story contest. Last round, more than 3,000 of you wrote original stories that can be read in under 3 minutes, all inspired by a photograph we posted at our website. Well, this round, we have a new challenge and a new judge, writer Ann Patchett, the best-selling author of, among others, Bel Canto and The Magician's Assistant, and she'll pick the winner. Ann Patchett is in Nashville, Tennessee. So good to have you.
Thank you.
Now, Ann, I understand we've torn you away from the closing pages of your forthcoming novel, and we're not going to say much about it except that you were just doing research by observing a cesarean section. How did that go?
It went really, really well up until about the last 2 minutes, and then I hit the floor and was unconscious for a very long time.
Why?
I passed out. There's only so much blood a novelist can take.
Yeah, but you're a novelist married to a doctor, so presumably you're used to some of that.
He's an internist.
Let's move on to the contest at hand and why we are both here. Each round, as you know, we've been setting up a device. So we had a photograph, we had a sentence, the nurse left work at 5 o'clock in one of the rounds, and that was a jumping-off point for the story. This time, Anne, you have a new idea for us. Tell us what it is.
Well, I picked 4 words, and they're dull little words, little everyday words that I want to see in all of the stories. The words are plant, button, trick, and fly, and people can use them as nouns, as adjectives, or as verbs. They can use them in any tense if they use them as verbs. But I think that it's really nice to have little markers to go by, something to sort of occupy one side of your brain while the other side of your brain is being very creative. So I think of these 4 words as the splint that will hold the story together.
Okay, so we have plant, button, trick, and fly. These are very, very simple words.
Right.
You might even say plain words. Why did you pick those words?
Well, because they were words that worked in a lot of different ways. You know, you can plant information. You can have a plant on your windowsill. I wasn't sure about these words being adjectives at first, and then my husband pointed out that you could have a button nose. Someone else pointed out you could have a trick knee or a fly ball. So they're very flexible. But it also means that everybody is going to be working from the same map. And I don't know. I liked it.
And this round, we're going to be assisted once again by the brilliant students from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You are actually a graduate of the workshop, and you trained as a short story writer. Why did you turn to novels?
You know, the reason that I turned to a novel was it was a point in my life. I was a waitress. I was 25, 26 years old. And my life was going nowhere, and I was writing short stories, and I was selling short stories, but I thought, man, I really need to write a novel, or I'm going to be a waitress for the rest of my life. That was the real reason I decided to try to write a novel, because at that time, I thought I was a dyed-in-the-wool short story writer. Once I wrote a novel, I never went back. That was my form. That was the place I felt really, really comfortable, and I loved writing novels.
Presumably, this kind of exercise, writing these short stories, are helpful for even people who write longer-form prose, I mean, novels, for example?
I think that's absolutely true. One thing that I find about short stories, because I was the series editor 4 years ago for Best American Short Stories, the stories were so good. The stories were so much better than the novels that I would read in the course of a given year. And I think that it's because people are willing to take more risks as a short story writer. If you write a bad short story, you'll throw it away. If you get halfway through it and it's not working, you can dump it and try something else. I see a lot more creativity and excitement in the short story.
Ann Patchett, you are going to be the judge this round. We are obviously so honored to have you. Tell all of us listening what you'll be looking for in these stories.
Well, I have a real prejudice towards a plot, and a lot of people think that a plot is old-fashioned, and I know that you can't get much of a plot into 600 words, but I do like a story in which something happens. And the thing that can happen can be extremely subtle. Having something happen doesn't mean that your main character gets run over by a bus, which is what I used to always tell my students, because they were always having their characters run over by buses, never cars. I think that a story really should capture the moment in which things turn. And as we all know, sometimes the most important things turn over a glance, a cup of coffee, walking the dog. It can be a very natural moment in your life, but the story focuses on the moment when things change. So that's what I like. I like creativity, I like a risk, and I like a little plot.
Okay, let's recap, Anne. Obviously, this is round four of our three-minute fiction contest. It is now open. We're going to be accepting submissions until 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, April 11th. We have to be able to read your stories aloud on the air in 3 minutes or less, so no more than 600 words. And Anne, can you remind us which words have to be included in that story?
Want to see the words plant, button, trick, and fly. And remember, you can use them as a noun, an adjective, or a verb, and you can use them in any tense if you use them as a verb.
So I guess people are really limited to 596 words because they have to use your four words.
That's right.
Okay, and there's only one entry per person. To send in your story, go to our website. That's npr.org/3-minute-fiction, and 3-minute fiction is all spelled out, no spaces. Students from the Iowa Writers Workshop will read your stories first, and they will send the best of the best to Anne. Meanwhile, we'll post weekly favorites at our website. Anne Patchett will read the winner story here on the program. And there's another prize, right, Anne?
Yes, there is. They're getting some Anne Patchett books.
Signed books, I hope.
Absolutely. They're getting my two nonfiction books, a memoir I wrote called Truth and Beauty, A Friendship, which is a lot about the Iowa Writers Workshop and writing. And then a second little tiny book I wrote that was based on a graduation speech I gave called What Now? And it's about following your dreams and doing what you want to do with your life.
That's author Anne Patchett. She's the judge of round four of our 3-minute fiction contest. Anne Patchett, thank you so much.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to this.
And once again, to submit your story, visit our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. If you've ever seen the 1955 film The Night of the Hunter, you'll have come across one of the most psychopathic characters in movie history. Robert Mitchum plays the serial killer, Reverend Harry Powell. The basic story is that Powell is looking for a hidden stash of money. And over the course of the film, we watch as he takes pleasure in the suffering and fear of others.
I can hear you whispering, children, so I know you're down there. I can feel myself getting awful mad. I'm out of patience, children. I'm coming to find you now.
That scene never gets any less creepy. Anyway, scientists may now have a better understanding for what motivates psychopaths. It was long thought that they lacked a certain brain function, the one that enables empathy, for example. But it turns out psychopathic behavior may be tied to the brain's reward system, the same one that causes addiction. That study's just been published in the journal Nature Neuroscience, and one of the authors is Josh Buchholz. He's a graduate student in neuroscience at Vanderbilt University, and he joins me from Nashville. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Guy.
So describe the difference between the brain of a psychopathic person and a normal person.
We can think of psychopathy as a personality disorder. It's a collection of related traits. There's this emotional and interpersonal dimension. They're glib and superficial. They lack fear. They lack empathy. And they also exhibit profound socially deviant behavior. They're impulsive. They need excitement. They have poor behavioral controls. And what prior research has shown is that psychopaths have changes in their brain in regions like the amygdala and the orbital frontal cortex that are involved in generating emotional experiences. And it's these brain changes that are thought to underlie the first dimension, their inability to experience things like empathy or regret and remorse. So what wasn't clear, though, is what drove them in the first place. So we think that these changes in the brain's reward system might promote a focus on reward, on obtaining a reward, be it money or sex or status.
Give us an example of how your research would apply to, say, a serial killer like Ted Bundy.
So what this research lets us know is that there's a new brain system that wasn't previously known to be involved in psychopathy. It's called the mesolimbic dopamine system. What the mesolimbic dopamine system is important for is organizing motivated behavior to obtain a reward. And because we now know that this mesolimbic dopamine reward system is involved in variation in these impulsive antisocial traits, this might lead the way for future studies that target the system as a way of reducing aggression and antisocial behavior.
Just clarify something for us. Is it that you either are a psychopath or you are not a psychopath?
That is an area of great debate in the field of psychopathy. Currently, it's thought that psychopathic traits operate along a continuum. So you can measure a range of psychopathic traits. And this is important for the purposes of our study because the people in our study were community volunteers with no diagnosable psychiatric disorders. So the people in our study might be your Machiavellian mother-in-law, your bullying boss, or your conniving coworker, but none of these people were out there committing violent crimes. Mm. None of these people had the same level of psychopathy as an incarcerated violent criminal.
Why is it important, from your perspective, for us to have a better understanding of this?
Well, there's a very compelling economic reason, and that is that crime is extremely expensive, and psychopaths commit more crime than anybody else. And so we get to make a decision as a society about where we want to spend our money. We can invest up front in, you know, understanding what makes a psychopath so that we can better know how to intervene before they begin to engage in all of these very costly behaviors, or we can spend our money on incarcerating them.
That's Josh Buchholz. He's a graduate student in neuroscience at Vanderbilt University, and he's the co-author of a new study that links the brain's reward system to violent behavior in psychopaths. Josh Buchholz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy.
If you heard the program last weekend, you'll know we were in Los Angeles. And one afternoon, we stopped into one of Jonathan Gold's favorite restaurants to have lunch. Gold is the food critic at the alternative newspaper, the LA Weekly. And 3 years ago, he became the first food writer in history to win a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. He eats almost everything, like guacamole topped with fried crickets.
I never realized that fried crickets were so freaking good.
He loves hot and sour soup with sea cucumber.
You sort of have to wrap your mind around that there are like slithery pieces of invertebrate floating around in it.
There's pretty much just one thing Jonathan Gold doesn't like. Eggs. Boiled, fried, doesn't matter.
It must be a childhood thing. My earliest conscious memory is of, you know, looking up at my mom when I was 2.5 years old and saying, you know, I have just eaten my last plate of scrambled eggs.
When we met Jonathan Gold for lunch at El Parian on West Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles, he was hard to miss. With his long, reddish hair, Gold's been described as a man who wouldn't look out of place on a pirate ship. This restaurant serves Mexican food, Jalisco style. And from the front, the place looks shuttered, abandoned. But inside, it's teeming with life.
I'll have an order in the birria, and he'll have one too. And
birria is the signature dish here. It's roast goat swimming in a savory, vinegary broth of drippings flavored with chili and cloves.
There's like crisp parts and there's chewy parts and there's soft parts.
It's really delicious.
Also, as you can see, they don't trim off the squirrely parts.
Before Jonathan Gold became a food critic, he decided to eat his way down this very street, Pico Boulevard, and he visited just about every restaurant on it. 25 years later, he says he tries to tell the story of Los Angeles through food.
When I was at the Los Angeles Times, there used to be a joke in the newsroom that there were vast parts of town that were only covered when there was a gang slang or I wrote about a restaurant. And I think through my work through the years that it gives people a fuller sense of what their city is like and who lives in it. I really like to make people unafraid of their neighbors, and you know, we have this vast and glorious mosaic, and you know, shining up and exposing various tiles of it, I think, is a worthy way to spend one's days.
Some of the language in your columns about restaurants, you know, the meat was spilling out like Beyonce spilling out of a tight suit, or you know.
I said that.
I mean, does it almost feel like there is a limited language for food writers? I mean, there's a limited kind of vocabulary. I mean, you hear words like delicate and...
In English, there is a very limited vocabulary for describing food. for example, when something is salty, you can say that it's salty. If you do say anything other than that, if you say briny, or if you say reminded me of the capacious deep, it's bad writing, because salty is so direct and it's so exact. Salty means salty. I started using friable for a while, which is a geologist term for something that is basically hard and unyielding and then yields all at once.
Yeah.
But I started getting letters from people at the geology department at Caltech, and they were bothered to have delicious food described as dirt.
Do you ever think about the power that you have over a restaurant's success? You write about a restaurant, and oftentimes people will flood that restaurant.
There are good aspects of that and there are bad aspects of it. The good aspect is I can take, especially in the sort of Sub Rosa restaurants that I often write about, I can take a hard-working business owner and make him a little bit more successful, and I like that. The bad aspect of that is that, unfortunately, I can probably close restaurants or make restaurants unsuccessful.
Has that ever happened?
Yeah, it's happened. It has almost always been restaurants that have been really praised by the most prominent critic in town and where I found the food to be not just bad but pretentious and bad. But I thought that they'd be able to withstand it. But the climate is pretty bad these days, and sometimes they can't. And just because somebody owns a restaurant that puts out bad food doesn't mean that they're evil. You know, they have a dog, they have kids, they have, you know, 50 people on the payroll who work really hard and don't deserve to be put out of work just because I find something that they're cooking aesthetically displeasing.
I mean, do you sort of walk a minefield doing this job because you are dealing with a sacred thing for so many different cultures and they're all here in L.A., and you're assessing their food?
Several years ago, I went to a Taiwanese restaurant in a mall. And I hated the meal I had more than almost any meal I had ever had. There was soup that was sort of mucilaginous, that was had this weird sort of sweet smokiness, like somebody had stubbed a cigarette out in it. There was the stir-fry of pork, black beans, and bitter melon, which, when you cook it right, has the lusciousness of the ripest, most delicious melon you've ever had, but is bitter like cancer medicine. There was a dish with what's often translated as stinky tofu, which is this fermented tofu that can often be delicious, but smells like garbage left festering outside for the entire month of August. And as I was eating this food and hating every single bite of it, I was looking around, and I realized the fault was not with the chef, who was doing what he did with great skill. The problem was with me and my cultural relativism. And I went back to the restaurant, and I went back, and I went back. And I went back so many times that the waitresses were practically trying to set me up with their daughters. And I think when I ended up writing about it, I had been 17 times. And I'm not sure I liked it any better, but I understood it. And I understood the way it could be. And I thought I was able to write about the restaurant in a reasonable manner. And I think that my experience and I think that my study of food has gotten me to the point where I can tell a really good version of a dish I don't like from a bad version of a dish I don't like.
It's Jonathan Gold. He's the food critic for the LA Weekly. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
There's no doubt that Tea Party members don't like the new health care law or much else about the Obama administration. But is it true that most Americans, as Republicans often claimed, are against what detractors call Obamacare? Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, and he joins us from Gallup's offices in Princeton, New Jersey. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
After the House bill was passed, your survey asked whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. What did you find?
Well, in that survey, Monday night, over 1,000 Americans, we found 49% saying good thing and good idea, and 40% saying a bad thing, bad idea, and that's about a 9-point spread in favor of what the House did on Sunday.
Who were the most enthusiastic supporters?
Well, this is not a great shock. Those, of course, who were Democrats were highly likely to support it. But beyond politics, it was those who didn't have insurance. Young people are less likely to have insurance than older Americans. People with low incomes who additionally are less likely to have insurance also were more enthusiastic about the bill.
Who were the least enthusiastic?
Well, again, politics, of course, is a huge part of this. That comes as a big duh, of course, at this point. Republicans much less likely. But as I mentioned, those who are older were less enthusiastic about the bill. Those with higher incomes were also less enthusiastic about what the House did.
I wonder if most people, I mean, it's always been said everybody backs a winner. You know, the health care bill passed, so if you were to take a poll, would people say, oh, yeah, yeah, I support it?
That could be part of it. And again, our poll was Monday night within 24 hours, and there was a lot of positive reaction. And we know in presidential approval research over the years, there's something called a rally effect. When something dramatic happens, often the public will push the approval rating up for the president. And that's why I think over the next several weeks we'll get a little better sense of how it's playing out.
Was it ever the case, as the Republicans often claimed in the debate leading up to the House vote, that most Americans were against restructuring the nation's health care system?
You know, that's a fascinating question, and I've spent a lot of time looking at the data. It is clear that for most polling that was done prior to the vote, tilted against rather than in favor of the new health care legislation. Now, there's been a lot of variance. Even in the couple of weeks leading up to the vote, there was a poll by the Kaiser Foundation out in California showing a plurality supported the idea. Even one of two ways the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll asked it found a one-point spread in favor of it. But at the same time, there were other polls showing double-digit margins against passage of the bill. Our Gallup poll taken before the vote showed a three-point margin against the bill. So the polls were kind of all over the map. But if you had to summarize, I would say the polling did tilt away from passage of the bill.
But not by a large margin.
That's right. When some people who opposed it said, you know, the vast majority of Americans, I always objected to that, because even in polling that showed there was a plurality against it, it typically was not a majority, because you did have a big don't know factor in there as well.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, and he joined us from Princeton, New Jersey. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you.